This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
Well, word has it that Chris Dodd is out there, or getting ready to get out there to filibuster this FISA bill that's going to grant immunity to the telco companies. We're still trying to track down the story. David's out calling his office. We're trying to get all the details on this. We'll get them to you as fast as we can. If so, this is a piece of a larger issue that I want to get into in this hour. And arguably the second hour as well. Yesterday was the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. And this is a time that, frankly, we need another Boston Tea Party. Put it beyond that. Greetings, by the way, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. I was in Michigan over the weekend and fighting snowstorms, and boy, was that a wild ride. After having spent Friday doing our program from Air America, Minnesota, which was a wonderful time, by the way. We had, after we got off the air, we went to a meet and greet with advertisers. And then that evening I did a book signing, and we slammed the bookstore. There must have been 350, 400 people there. And they only had 200 chairs, 220 chairs. And there was a lot of people standing. I thank those of you who showed up and apologize to those of you who had to stand for an hour and a half. But it was a wonderful time. Met a lot of great people. I love Minnesota. I love Minneapolis. It's one of my favorite towns. It's one of those cities where you can get around in the dead of winter and never have to go outside. They've got this whole kind of skywalk system that connects all these buildings downtown. It's really cool. But anyhow, after that, I went to Michigan to visit my mother and my brothers. And one of my brothers was telling me how the housing in the neighborhood that I grew up in South Lansing. This is just a basic blue-collar, working-class neighborhood. My dad bought this house in 1955 or 56, I think it was, for like $13,000 or $15,000. And it's a house that, you know, would have been worth, in the last year or so, maybe $100,000 in that neighborhood. I mean, it's that type of basic middle-class, blue-collar, central, three-bedroom, one-bathroom house with a nice basement. He said, this house has lost its value, or that neighborhood, but, you know, in general, the houses in that neighborhood have lost 30% of their value in the last year. And I was talking to I had lunch with my three brothers, my three younger brothers and my mom, and they were telling stories about going to the tax assessor's office and saying, hey, you know, my house is worth 20% less than it was 2 years ago. You're taxing me at the rate that it was worth a couple of years ago. How about a reassessment? And one of them actually succeeded in getting that done, and which raised the larger question. My brother Stan, as I recall, said, you know, what's this going to do to the state? If right across the state, housing values go down 30, 40, 50%, and this is not limited to Michigan, by the way. Michigan is one of the most hard-hit states in the country. But this is spreading all over the United States. And it's happening, by the way. Again, going back to the neighborhood my dad bought this house in when I was 6 years old, and that my mom and dad lived in for 50 years. That as the value of these of that neighborhood goes down, as the value of neighborhoods all over the state go down, as the value of neighborhoods all over the country go down, how are governments going to maintain any function? I mean, how are the schools going to continue to operate when they operate on a property tax base? And what is the beginning of all this? The beginning of all this is because, you know, as I said, in the neighborhood where my parents bought the house, where I grew up, in that neighborhood, I think Steve said that there are right now six houses. This was a neighborhood of probably, I don't know, it's like seven city blocks. I don't know how many houses are in seven city blocks, but a little subdivision that was built for the guys coming back from World War II. You know, there were a lot of subdivisions built like that in the late 40s and early 50s. And in that neighborhood, there's six or seven houses in foreclosure right now. Now, this is a middle-class neighborhood in Lansing, Michigan, and all these houses are in foreclosure in large part because people who originally had 20- and 30-year loans, they thought they were doing well, everything was well, and then they decided, hey, let's put a garage on this thing, or let's put an attic, you know, turn the attic into a bedroom or something. So they go out and they take an extra mortgage, and they end up with an adjustable rate mortgage or a subprime mortgage. And now all of a sudden the interest rates are being jacked up or doubled or tripled and they can't afford it and they're getting wiped out and on top of that, the house isn't worth what it was. I mean, they were sold this bill of goods of, well, you know, you can always, you refinance now and you can take $20,000 out of your house and the rate's going to go up in 3 years, but don't worry about that because in 3 years you'll be able to refinance again because the house will be worth even more. And you'll be able to take even more money out. Or you'll be able to sell the house in 3 years and pay this thing off. People bought this stuff. And now they're getting whacked. And because of all these foreclosures, of course, the banks are trying to unload the houses at anything they can get for them. And the net effect is they're driving down the values of these houses. And those become, I mean, you know, when you do an appraisal, you look at the last 5 or 10 sales in the neighborhood, and they're all running 30 to 50% below what the market was. So what we're seeing is the result of deregulation. This is the story the media will not talk about, because the corporate media in America wants itself to be deregulated. They don't want there to be rules that say you can't own a newspaper and a radio station and a television station in the same city and basically control all the ways that people get information in that city. They don't like that. They don't want that. But what we're seeing is the absolute, abject, disastrous failure of Reaganism. Now, since they won't talk about what's really causing the problem, which is on the first hand, starting with the Reagan administration, the deregulation of the banking industry, which immediately led to the savings and loan crisis during the first Bush administration, $500 billion payout, $500 trillion payout, bailout, including bailing out one of the Bush sons, Neil Bush, the Silverado savings and loan out in Colorado. In addition to creating a series of disasters, of boom and bust disasters, the Reagan deregulation has brought about this disaster. And so who are they going to blame? They can't talk about, well, it was the failure of deregulation. Reaganism as a philosophy doesn't work. It was stupid in the first place. You know, it was an attempt to roll back the New Deal. The New Deal was basically regulated large portions of capitalism in the United States, particularly the banking industry. And let us keep in mind also that it was Bill Clinton who lobbied for and signed the Glass-Steagall Act, which ultimately deregulated the bank industry, allowing banks to buy securities, which is one of the reasons why banks are in trouble right now as well. But this all goes back to this whole Reagan.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This all goes back to, let's take apart the government and throw us all to the mercy of the big corporations. So who are they blaming? They can't blame we the people. They can't say, well, it was the failure of deregulation, because they're the ones who did the deregulation and they want more of it, so they can suck more money out of our pockets. So what they're blaming is you and me. This from the editor of Fortune magazine. The headline, are Americans too lazy? U.S. workers can't compete unless they work harder. Oh, yeah. So if we work 14 hours a day and 7 days a week and we have 12-year-olds working, then we can compete. As is the case, by the way, with Christmas ornaments being made in China. Ellen Ratner broke this story over at WorldNetDaily.com. I'm assuming it's also over at TalkRadioNews.com. Ellen Ratner's our regular news reporter. She talks about the Guangzhou Huanya Gift Company. In the company's own words, they have a long, friendly, collaborative relationship with industry leader Walmart. High school workers putting in 12 to 15 hours a day, 7 days a week. Children as young as 12. How did we learn about this? The students smuggled evidence of the abuses out of the factory. Workers are required to put in a regular shift of 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. To keep a job, they must also volunteer for 30 hours a week of overtime, unpaid overtime, giving workers a 100-hour work week. If they try to take off Sundays, they're docked 2.5 days of pay or fired. So here's Fortune magazine saying, this should be what we aspire to. This should be what we aspire. Americans are too lazy. We're working much less than we used to. I'm quoting from the Fortune magazine people. People with jobs are working fewer hours. Well, actually, no. It's at every job they're working fewer hours. I'll explain that right after the break. That's the real kicker. Yeah, there's plenty more wood. Oh, my. So, anyhow, here's what it all gets back to. First of all, to my rebuttal to the Fortune article, are Americans too lazy? U.S. workers can't compete globally unless they work harder. Yeah, right. And then they say people with jobs are working fewer hours. That's because people with jobs have 2 and 3 jobs. And they're part-time jobs because the employers don't want to allow them to be full-time jobs because then, God forbid, they may have to pay benefits and unemployment insurance and things like that. And so we have more and more Americans who are working 2 and 3 jobs because they can't find one decent full-time job. This is what's the old pun? You know, figures never lie, but liars can figure. This is obscene. This is absolutely obscene. A Fortune magazine article, Are Americans Too Lazy? But there is a fundamental reality here, and it was so clearly visible to me when I was in Michigan over the weekend. And I see it all over the United States. And that is that in order for an economy to work, a local economy, something of value must be produced. You have to produce something of value. You can't have a local economy that works with nothing of value being produced. It's just that simple. And so, you know, for example, when Michigan was the auto worker center of the world, or the auto manufacturing center of the world, and cars were being manufactured and parts for cars were being manufactured, you know, my dad's tool and die shop, probably 80% of their business was for Oldsmobile. And there was a big Oldsmobile factory right there in Lansing. And before he worked there, he worked at a tool and die, or at a drop forge that made stuff for General Motors. So what happens is when you're converting something into increased value, you're adding value to something. Excuse me. When you're adding value to something, you're bringing in, you know, iron ore. Actually, Louise's brother's a ship captain up on Lake Superior. They move iron ore from, you know, one end of the lake to the other. You bring in iron ore, you convert it to iron. You convert the iron to steel. That increases its value. Every step along the way, it increases its value. And then you convert the steel into an automobile or convert it into a TV set or something like that. And that increases its value. And every time you increase value like that, by increasing the value through the addition of human labor or human intellect, you generate revenue. You generate a profit. And that profit is being generated in the local community. And much of the consequence of that profit is being paid as wages to the local people. And then they use those wages to buy things from the local stores and the local 7-Eleven and the local clothing store and whatnot. And boom, you've got an economy. And then they can afford to pay for a mortgage and for their home. And so these geniuses, and I use the word sarcastically, these flaming idiots, the Alan Greenspans, the Tom Friedmans, the Milton Friedmans of the world, the frankly George Herbert Walker Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bushes of the world, the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC guys, they all came along and they said, and what was it, yesterday, day before, I saw John McCain going, I'm one of the nation's biggest free traders. They came along and they said, we don't need to make stuff in America anymore. We just need to make sure that the big transnational corporations are showing a profit. If the stock market goes up, everything's fine. Now, these are millionaires talking to millionaires, and they've got their money stashed in the stock market. And when they see the money in the stock market go up, they think, oh, yeah, hey, look at that. The stock market went up. My profits went up. I must be doing well. The economy must be doing well. Isn't that a great thing? And what they're forgetting is that one of the reasons the stock market went up is because those jobs making washing machines in Grand Rapids, Michigan, making cars in Detroit, Michigan, and in Flint, Michigan, making auto parts down in Lansing, Michigan, to use Michigan as the example, although we're seeing this all across the United States in 1,000 industries, that those jobs making those things are now in Mexico, they're now in China, they're now in Singapore, they're now in Vietnam, they're now in Malaysia. And because those things are being made there, guess what? There's a huge boom in those countries. Why? Because it's being driven from the worker up. When you manufacture things locally, people get money, they get the money, they spend the money, they build the local economy. A local community has to generate wealth somehow. In the early days of this country, the primary way that wealth was generated was by producing goods, food, farms. Farms generate wealth. You turn your labor into a crop. And then we had the Industrial Revolution, and we produced things. And because we're no longer producing things, because we have destroyed our production, we have no industrial policy in the United States, we have no rational trade policy. And right after the break, I want to share with you just some of the mind-boggling details of this, and then we'll take your calls at 866-303-2270. Because we have no industrial policy in the United States whatsoever, and haven't for all practical purposes since Reagan, we're seeing the impoverishment of America, and it's going to get worse. Past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270. You want to drop into our live chat room. Go to TomHartman.com and just click the chat button up at the top, and it'll drop you in there. Strange things happening out there in the world. Well, maybe. As they say from the wire services, the increasingly contentious race for the Democratic presidential nomination got a little bit nastier today as Senator Hillary Clinton charged that her chief rival, Senator Barack Obama, wet his bed when he was a toddler. Iowans have grown used to displays of testiness on the part of the leading Democratic contenders in recent weeks, but few were prepared for Senator Clinton's accusation that her surging opponent had been a bedwetter. Moments after her campaign released this latest bombshell, Senator Clinton went to great lengths to show that the bedwetting incident, while occurring when the Illinois senator was only 3 years old, was relevant to the current presidential campaign. At a campaign stop in Cedar Rapids, Senator Clinton said that the alleged bedwetting incident should not disqualify Senator Obama from the White House, but should make Democrats think long and hard about voting for him in next month's caucuses. Personally, Senator Clinton said, I don't have anything against a bedwetter in the Oval Office, but you can be sure that the Republican right-wing attack machine will have a field day with this kind of thing. At a campaign appearance in Davenport, Senator Obama brushed off his alleged bedwetting as an isolated incident and added an apparent jab at Senator Clinton. I'm not the only one who's so scared about this race that I'm peeing myself now. In response to Senator Obama's remarks, Senator Clinton later released a statement referring to herself as rubber and Senator Obama as glue. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's tongue-in-cheek. That's from Andy Borowitz, the Borowitz Report, borowitzreport.com. And thank you, Andy, for letting us use that. Just to wrap this topic up, and then I want to get to your thoughts on this, but this is... The reason why all this has happened is something called global free trade, and it is not free. Tom Friedman is wrong. Milton Friedman was wrong. Ross Perot was right. Bill Clinton was wrong. Bush was wrong. Let me say that again. Ross Perot was right. For example, with regard to food, a lot of countries protect their local farmers. They pretty much have to. But with changing weather patterns around the world and surging demand for food, as we now have passed 6 billion, we're heading towards 7 billion humans, things are changing. This is from the Financial Times today. Turkey is the latest country to announce a reduction in custom duty. See, most people thought all the tariffs were done away with. Well, all of our tariffs were done away with. That's why we no longer have manufacturing of any consequence in the United States. Most other countries still have tariffs. China still has tariffs. Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, Turkey, and particularly on agricultural goods. Turkey reduced their import tariff for wheat from 130%. In other words, if you wanted to import wheat into Turkey, you had to pay a 130% import tax. Why? Because they wanted their local farmers to have an advantage. Well, they're running low on wheat. So they reduced the import tariff from 130% to 8%. For corn, from 130% to 35%. They scrapped the previous 100% duty for barley. The European Union, the world's top importer of wheat and one of the largest buyers of soybeans and corn, also has announced that it will set zero import duties for cereals starting next June. The cuts follow. This is Jennifer Blaz writing in London in today's Financial Times of London. Let's see here. The cut follows in countries such as China, Russia, Mexico, Morocco, Azerbaijan, Bosnia, Egypt, Philippines, Taiwan, Bangladesh, India, Nigeria, Ghana, and Peru, all of them cutting tariffs on food. Some have said these may be short-term measures. They're going to go back to protecting their local industry. See, this is how countries have been doing it since the days of Adam Smith. This is how countries have been doing it since the days of the Roman Empire. You protect your local domestic industries with tariffs. The only people who win with so-called global free trade are transnational corporations. Sure, it drives up the stock market because it's the stock in those companies. And sure, the CEOs are making hundreds of millions and billions and trillions, well, not trillions yet, but tens of billions of dollars in pay and in stock options. But the average person gets screwed. And what happens to states all across the United States, what's happening in Michigan right now is soon to come to a town near you. Because the industrial infrastructure of this country and soon the, and as we're watching, people say, oh, well, it's not a manufacturing economy, it's a service economy now. So you've got to go to school, you got to go to college and get educated so you can provide services like computer training and things. Well, the service industry is getting wiped out too, because in the United States, to get a PhD can cost $100,000, whereas in Denmark to get a PhD, in France to get a PhD, in Germany to get a PhD, zero. It's free. In Sweden, in Norway, right across the board, or very inexpensive. So we're losing right across the board. Bill Gates out there saying, I have to import more people from India who will work for the $30,000 instead of the $70,000 I'm paying American. Well, it's not quite that crass, but you get the bottom line. Bill Gates arguing for more H-1B visas to import more people. Well, we're just not turning them out in our schools. Could be because it's so expensive. Or is it that Americans are just stupid? Well, the net effect of this is that the incomes of the top 1% of Americans over the last 2 years exceeded the total income of the poorest 20% of Americans. Total. All 20% of Americans, the top 1% made more than $524 billion. The top 1% made, the bottom 20% made $383 billion. On average, this is from the Congressional Budget Office, on average, incomes for the top 1% of households rose by $465,700 each, or 42% adjusted for inflation. Top 1%, their increase over the last 2 years, 42%. Incomes of the poorest fifth, that's the bottom 20%, an average of $200, 1.3%. This is why. You want to see a change? Elect your congressperson, elect your senator, and elect a president who is going to say no to these insane trade policies. And the only person I know who's running for president who's saying that, seriously running for president, is John Edwards. And it's so important that you be contacting your members of the House and Senate and saying, no more of these crazy trade deals. Get us out of the WTO right now. Let's go back to a rational tariff-based policy. Craig in Akron, Ohio. Hey, Craig, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you doing?
Just great.
Thank you, Speaker. How are you?
I am fine, and I will get better. Yes,
I know. I don't know why people say that. I don't know why I said it either.
I love it. So what's up,
Listen, I work for an American company. I work for a company that's union based. It's in the Rust Belt area. This company owns maybe 20 other companies, and the first thing this guy does is buys these companies, make sure these guys got good health insurance, and everybody's paid well, and he's never sold a single company he's ever purchased. How come we can't, as a grassroots organization, group of people here in you know, this Rust Belt area up here, get this done ourselves? I mean, the guys like this that I work for, he's not going to buy everything out there, but we can start making things, or maybe we can get together with a group of people who can work together, who can make TVs, computers, wash machines, and dryers, and things that we can quit buying this crap from overseas.
Right. Well, first of all, as long as there are no tariffs. I mean, it used to be that if you wanted to import washing machines from overseas, you had to pay a tariff. I don't know what it was, but it was probably in the neighborhood of 30% or 40%. So that if they were made 30% or 40% cheaper overseas and you bought one made here, the cost was the same. When they did away with the tariffs, when they signed the WTO and GATT, when Clinton pushed that thing through, and it wasn't just Clinton. I mean, again, this started with Reagan, but Clinton really, you know, put the nail in the coffin. When that happened, companies were saying, hey, this is nuts. Why am I making washing machines here when I can make them in China for 30% less? And as long as the price of oil was low enough that they could ship them from China here, and when all was said and done, it was 15% less, they're still making more money. So number one, as the price of oil goes up, you know, that's going to help somewhat, I suppose. As the cost of the dollar goes down, it's impoverishing Americans, but it's going to make our imports cheaper, and it's going to make it harder for us to buy things from overseas because we'll have to use more dollars. That may help in some way. I mean, that's the, quote, monetary policy technique. That's the technique that that Jon Snow and you know, the Bushies have been promoting, is instead of managing trade, let's manage our currency. It's nuts.
No, I understand. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, but the third thing, what you're talking about is people getting together and buying their companies. And there have been a number of efforts to do this outside the United States. There have been several countries in Latin America, and I once had the list. We did a whole show on this about 2 years ago. I don't have the list in front of me right now. But there are several countries where I know that Chavez is encouraging this in Venezuela, for example, where the workers can get together and buy out the company, and the government will give them basically short-term, no-interest or very low-interest loans to enable it to happen to get the company back on its feet. That's what we should be doing in Iraq, is we should be saying to the Iraqis, we'll help you put those 200 factories, those 200 major industries that got shut down and never reopened because we thought that transnational corporations were going to come in and buy them. We'll help you get them back on their feet. And that's what we should be doing here in the United States, absolutely, is having worker. Jeff Gates has written, he's a brilliant guy, he's written a number of books about this, you know, the whole co-op and worker-owned company movement. But, yeah, I mean, it's a tough one for a business person to say, okay, do I do the right thing or do I do the profitable thing? And, you know, thank God for your employer.
We purposely walk in there and tell people, listen, we're United Steelworkers. We're not going to be the cheapest product out on the world here, out on the market, but we feel we build a better one, and let me show you the reasons why. And that really does work. And I think that you could probably sell somebody on paying an extra 50 or 100 bucks for a television set or a computer if you stood on those same bases.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right.
All right, I hear the music. Yeah. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thanks a lot, Craig. Good talking to you. 45 minutes past the hour. I got to tell you about a company that's, you know, don't buy Chinese toys, or rather, buy American toys right after this break.
Oh, you better watch out. I'm telling you why. The FAA doubts that Santa will fly. Santa Claus is coming by ground. His bags were too weird. They're posting his bum. They're checking his beard. He's getting the one. Santa isn't leaving the ground. He'd take a flight if he could. They thought his suit looked weird. They profiled him as bad, not good, just because of his long beard. They'll post a reward, 'cause last time he flew, he tried to board his sleigh with shampoo. TSA does not like his ilk. He might bring on some cookies and milk.
Oh, heaven forbid! I have a TSA story. When I was flying back from Minneapolis let's see, what day was this? Well, over the weekend anyway. I showed up at the, to go through security, and I hand the guy my ticket, and he looks at it, and he goes, Tom Hartman. Yeah, are you the Tom Hartman who's on the radio? And I said, yeah. And at that moment, I didn't know if I was going to get frog marched off in handcuffs or what. And he goes, I listen to your show every day. It's great. I was like, well, thank you. It was my high point TSA experience of my life. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. The Tom Hartman program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Here's the website I promised you during the last break. Carrie and Andrew Menger, parents of two children, decided enough already. Where can we buy products not made in China? Now, most of them made in the United States, but a few of them are, made in countries like Germany or England or Spain or something like that. So they launched a website, and I checked it out this morning, and it looks great. NMC, like not made China, toys.com. NMCtoys.com. Not made in China, toys.com. NMC Toys, T-O-Y-S, toys.com. So if you're doing your Christmas shopping and you want to buy something that's not made in China, check it out. Andrew in Newark, California. Hey, Andrew, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello. Wow, I'm finally on. I'm a machinist, and I'm required to buy my own tools. This is a pretty common thing. And what I'm finding is it's very hard to find American-made tools. These are the things we use to make everything else. And if it's a really high quality thing, it tends to be made in Europe or Japan. If it's a cheap something, it tends to come from India and China.
Yeah. And so if there were a world war, if there were a disaster, if oil were to go to $300 a barrel because some idiot in the White House decided to blow up Iran, then all of a sudden the stuff that we use to make the stuff that makes the stuff would no longer be available, and we would be, without getting obscene, we would be up a creek. We would be in trouble. We would be out of luck. Yeah.
If we wanted to start making, tanks right now from scratch, we'd have to start by making lathes.
That's right, which we don't make in the United States anymore.
We make some. I mean, there are some American, but, it's hard to find good stuff.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I remember, when my dad worked in the machine shop, I remember going out looking at these giant machines. And if I thought long enough, I could probably remember even the names of some of them. And there were a couple that were made in Germany, I know, but the vast majority of them were made in the United States. You'd see the city where they were made, right there on the big old plate on them, these great big huge machines. And the tools, the small, because there was a tool and die making shop. And absolutely right, Andrew. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. Oh, my. Justin in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Justin, welcome to the program.
How's it going, Tom?
Just fine. What's up?
Well, listening to a couple of your previous callers and the conversation, I'm a local iron worker in the 25 here in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems I see is that people don't realize that our economy is circular. I was talking to a gentleman, and he owns several car dealerships in Texas. And he was telling me, he says, why would I hire an iron worker from the union when I can hire several workers for a quarter to an eighth of the amount of money? And I asked him, I said, how many of those workers are going to then come back and be able to buy your cars from you?
Right. It's the old Henry Ford story.
Yeah. They don't realize that it's a circle, and by pinching it off and taking more than they're giving back, that they're actually hurting themselves. So when your previous caller said, I think he said something like, either quality products or more money, I think it's the same thing. If you hire workers and pay them a good wage, they're in turn, they're going to come back and they're going to boost your product, your profits by buying your product.
That's what builds an economy. Franklin Roosevelt got it and Ronald Reagan didn't get it, and thus the American economy is dying. Well said. Thank you very much for the call. In fact, my youngest brother, John, is the shop steward for his union, for the printers union, and a printers union in Lansing, Michigan. And he said that they were in negotiations last week. And he sat down with the person for management and who said, we would like you guys to sign this thing in your new contract that says that the company can terminate your pensions at any time without notice, essentially, any time at its own will. And John says to her, he says, would you sign something that says your pension can go away? And she says, well, you know, he says, she gave me this big, long, you know, speech. And he said, no, bottom line, would you sign something right now that says that you would be willing to give up your pension? And she said, well, no. And he said, why do you expect me to? Domingo in New Jersey. Hey, Domingo.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Yeah.
All right, well, I think you should run for president.
Well, see, I'd make a lousy politician, Domingo. I'm a good talk show host, a pretty good writer. I'll do what I do well. I'll let other people, you know, there's some very good politicians out there. We just all need to get behind them.
Well, I'm just saying, I'm a longshoreman by trade also for 20 years, and just the ships that come in, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got, say, 2,000, 1,000 of them are coming in full from the Far East. Then you got about 800 empties loading back on to fill up back in the Far East. And then you have 200. Out of those 200, maybe 100 are just waste paper that they recycle in the Far East. 40-ton boxes of waste paper that can recycle back in the Far East to make boxes and whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what's exactly, Domingo, exactly. That's what's happened. When Reagan came into office, we were the world's largest exporter of finished goods. We manufactured things. That gave good jobs, which built the middle class of America. Now we are the world's largest importer of finished goods and the world's largest exporter of stuff like waste paper. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Call. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back to our program. Chris Dodd throwing, what's the metaphor? I don't know, throwing sand in the administration's, no, that's not it. Throwing tea in the harbor. Maybe that's the metaphor. Chris Dodd on the floor of the Senate just a few minutes ago.
Mr. President, here we are, facing a final decision on whether the telecommunications companies will get off the hook for good.
Now, are they going to get off the hook for good, these corporations who went along with the criminal requests from the Bush administration? Now, I suppose at a certain level you say, you know, my country comes to me and they say, will you please do something? And I say, yeah, sure. I mean, after all, it's my country. I should do the thing that they're asking. But these are huge corporations that have plenty of lawyers, and they know right from wrong, and they know what they should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing, and they certainly know telecommunications law. And, in fact, one of them even said no, Quest Communications. They said, no, we won't do that. And sort of like Don Siegelman, the governor from Alabama, who had an election stolen from him, one of the little details that wasn't mentioned in the MSNBC report, vote fraud, election fraud, not vote fraud, election fraud, had an election stolen from him by the Republicans, had the audacity to complain about it, and now has ended up in a federal prison. The head of Quest Communications, the one telecom company who said no to the Bush administration, he's in prison now as well. But anyhow, Chris Dodd saying, are we going to let the rest of these guys off the hook?
The president's allies are intent, as they ever have been, on making this happen. They want immunity back in this bill at all costs. But what they're truly offering is secrecy in place of openness, fiat in place of law.
And that's really the bottom line, is are we a nation of laws or are we a nation of, I don't know, secrets? Are we a nation of big corporations and equally big government owned by those big corporations rather than answerable to we the people, in large part because of this insane 1976 Buckley versus Vallejo Supreme Court decision and others since then? Are we a government of money? Or are we a government of law? And Harry Reid, I am becoming so disappointed with the leadership of Harry Reid. I mean, this guy, I don't know how to do it, frankly. I really don't know how to do it. Well, it's a vote of all the senators. But somebody needs to stand up and say that they're going to take on Harry Reid for the leadership. Because he has allowed the Republicans to roll over him, to steamroll him. There has been no response. There have been no theatrics. The guy has, Harry Reid, he's a nice guy. We don't need a nice guy right now running the Senate. We need somebody who's going to take names and kick butt. And Chris Dodd looks like maybe he's the guy. I mean, Chris Dodd is a pretty decent guy. He's a very progressive senator. And I don't think that this is part of his campaign for the presidency. He continues.
And in place of the forthright argument and judicial deliberation that ought to be the country's pride, two simple words from the president's mouth ring out. Trust me.
Yeah, right. I don't, you know, so George Bush says, trust me, and Harry Reid says, okay, we'll send some legislation down the road that says, trust you. Similarly, Ron Paul on the Tea Party anniversary, this was yesterday, was the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. You know, in 1773, this is when the Boston Tea Party happened. Just before that happened, just months before it happened, well, as you can tell, it happened in December. And in the spring of 1773, Thomas Jefferson published a pamphlet called A Summary View of the Rights of British Americans. And basically it was a paper on, you know, we would like Great Britain to offer these rights to us, but these are the things that we'll do to make sure that we're good British citizens. He was not calling for independence from England in 1773. And yet by 1774, he was seriously talking about it, meeting with other people, meeting with the subversives, the rabble-rousers. Again, when I was in Michigan, I stayed with my brother Steve. Steve is, like my dad was, mom is, a collector of stuff. And Steve had a newspaper from 1773. And there was, he's going to make a copy of it and send it to me. I'll share it with you in the show in a week or so when we get it all together. But it was incredible because it was referring, this is in 1773, it was referring to those people who wanted to separate from England as the terrorists. It was written by a guy who was going to take his family and move back to England because he was living in fear. He was afraid that the rabble-rousers were going to get him. So anyhow, this is the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party, and frankly, I think we need another one. And people, very often you say, well, what was the Boston Tea Party? Well, that was no taxation without representation. That was because the British raised the tax on tea, and therefore we threw the tea in the harbor and said, lower taxes! No. That's not what happened. The Tea Act of 1773 did, in fact, bring about, it was the straw that broke the camel's back, it did bring about the Boston Tea Party. But the Tea Act of 1773, go back and read it, lowered the tax on tea. Now, why would lowering the tax on tea cause the colonists to get so infuriated? I was trying to figure this out myself, and back about, I don't know, 6 years, 8 years ago, something like that, I was doing the research for a book that ultimately became Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, one of the six, I think, books that I've, maybe seven, that I've written on politics in the United States and the history of politics. And looking through old bookstores, looking for books from that time, I could not find a single book in print now actually about the Boston Tea Party that wasn't just a children's book that basically echoed the line that it was no taxation without representation, they blew the, you know, put the tea in the harbor, blah. Until I found in an antique bookstore, for a couple $1,000s, I mean, this book cost me a good chunk of what I got as an advance for writing the book that ultimately came out of it, but it was titled A Retrospective of the Boston Tea Party with a Memoir by George R.T. Hughes, a survivor of the little band of patriots who drowned the tea in Boston Harbor in 1773. It was published some 61 years after the Boston Tea Party. George Hughes was 17 years old when it happened. He was now in his, what, 80s? There had been a 50-year vow of silence among all of them, and pretty much everybody had died by then. So George Hughes sat down with a biographer, and he told the story of what happened. And let me just quote from this the only firsthand account in existence of the Boston Tea Party and what led up to it. George Robert Twelfth Hughes, George R.T. Hughes, he says, the East India Company received permission to transport tea free of all duty from Great Britain to America. See, they got the tax cut. This was the first globalization. This was the first international free trade, global free trade. Tom Friedman would have loved it. Back to George Hughes. The East India Company received permission to transport tea free of all duty from Great Britain to America, allowing it to wipe out New England-based tea wholesalers and small stores and take over the tea business in all of America. Hence, It was no longer the small vessels of private merchants who went to Ventea for their own account in the ports of the colonies, but on the contrary, ships of an enormous burthen that transported immense quantities of this commodity. The colonies were now arrived at the decisive moment when they must cast the die and determine their course. Basically, it came down to, are we going to take on Walmart and the government that has made it possible and try to return small business? Because keep in mind, small businesses, tea shops were like, tea was the drug of choice for the colonists. Everybody got together. Every block had a tea shop. That's where people met. There were tea shops where men met. There were tea shops where women met. There were tea shops where people got together. I mean, every kind of tea shop. Tea shops and bars, that was it. Those were the centers of activity. Rusticus. We still don't know who he was. He sends out a pamphlet just before this. He says, he's talking about the East India Company. He says, their conduct in Asia for some years past has given simple proof how little they regard the laws of nations, the rights, liberties, or lives of men. They have levied war, excited rebellions, dethroned lawful princes, and sacrificed millions for the sake of gain. The revenues of mighty kingdoms have entered into their coffers. And these not being sufficient to glut their avarice, they have by the most unparalleled barbarities, extortions, and monopolies stripped the miserable inhabitants of their property and reduced whole provinces to indigence and ruin. 1,500,000, it is said, perished by famine in 1 year, not because the earth denied its fruits, but because this company and their servants engulfed all the necessaries of life. In other words, they became the sole source from which you could buy food. And set them at so high a price that the poor could not purchase them. Monopolies. Gee, is history repeating itself? Is Chris Dodd saying no to the big transnational corporations, the big telecom companies, saying no, you can't commit crimes, even with the complicity of our government, which is equally criminal in this? And how's it going to go? Where's Harry Reid going to stand on this? Go to callcongress.org and find out. Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Is it time for another tea party? Is it time for another Boston Tea Party? Is one happening? Finally, Chris Dodd, God bless him, standing up on the floor of the Senate, and he says he's going to filibuster this piece of legislation. We'll see how successful he is. The filibuster does require the support at a certain level of the leader of the Senate. And here's a Democrat. I mean, typically it would be the party that's out of power filibustering a piece of legislation. Here's a Democrat saying he's going to shut this thing down. He's going to stop it. And, you know, we're trying to get the latest word here. David calling Chris Dodd's office every 15 minutes and, keeping an eye on the wire services and the news and whatnot on what's going on with this piece of legislation. But it's the Boston Tea Party all over again. And high time. In the real Boston Tea Party, back in the end of 1773, here was a pamphlet. It was asking people to come to Faneuil Hall. It said, George Robert Twelvetree Hughes, writing about this in his autobiography, said, thus things appear to be hastening to a disastrous issue. The people of the country arrived in great numbers and inhabitants of the town assembled. This assembly on the 16th of December, 1773, was the most numerous ever known, there being more than 2,000 from the country present. The group called for a vote on whether to oppose the landing of the tea. The vote was unanimously affirmative, and it's related by one historian of the scene that, quote, a person disguised after the manner of the Indians who was in the gallery shouted at this juncture the cry of war, and that the meeting dissolved in the twinkling of the eye, and the multitude rushed in a mass to Griffin's Wharf. That night, Hughes dressed as an Indian, blackening his face with coal dust, and joined crowds of other men in hacking apart the chests of tea and throwing them into the harbor. In all, the 342 chests of tea, over 90,000 pounds of tea thrown overboard that night, were enough to make 24 million cups of tea and were valued by the East India Company at 9,659 pounds sterling, or in today's dollars, just over $1 million. In response, the British Parliament immediately passed the Boston Port Act, stating that the Port of Boston would be closed until the good citizens of Boston reimbursed the East India Company for the tea they had destroyed. You get it? This was the first Seattle WTO protest. Only this was serious, serious vandalism. The colonists refused. A year and a half later, the colonists would again state their defiance of the East India Company and Great Britain by taking on British troops in an armed conflict at Lexington and Concord on April 19, 1775, referred to as the shot heard around the world. That war, which was triggered by a transnational corporation and its government patrons, trying to deny American colonists a fair and competitive local marketplace, would end with independence for the colonies. After the Revolutionary War, by the way, Thomas Jefferson proposed a Bill of Rights with 12 amendments, one of which would, and I'm quoting Jefferson now, ban commercial monopolies forever, end quote, making it illegal for corporations to own other corporations to do business with more than one specific product or market, and thus forever preventing another oppressive commercial juggernaut like the East India Company from arising again in North America to threaten democracy and oppress the people. You know, it's amazing the history of this country. They don't teach the fact that this country was actually founded by the British East India Company. They created the Jamestown, the first colony, was named after King James, who was the second of the two British monarchs who were stockholders in the East India Company. Jamestown was in the state of Virginia, which was named after the Virgin Queen, Queen Elizabeth I, who was the first stockholder and founder of the British East India Company. So are we going to let the corporations off the hook today? You can call your senator. Go to callcongress.org. You'll get the information. It's all right there. Are they going to let the big companies off the hook or not? Because, see, here's the problem from the administration's point of view is if these companies get prosecuted, what's their defense going to be? Their defense is going to be Alberto Gonzalez, George Bush, John Negroponte. These guys, they told me to do it. And so then the court is going to say, okay, let's bring in these guys from the government and ask them under oath what they said and did, and you're going to discover crimes so high, so onerous, such clear and blatant violations of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution that says that the only way the government can look at our records, at our personal papers, at listening on our phone conversations, the only way is if a warrant is issued. Let me actually read you the thing. I mean, it's just a sentence or two. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. Somebody has to swear that you're committing a crime, and they have evidence of it that will rise to the level of probable cause, that you're probably committing a crime. And that warrant must particularly describe the place to be searched and the persons and things to be seized. And instead, we got the telco companies snooping on our every conversation. Level 5, local calls. This is incredible. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Chris Dodd, filibustering on the floor of the Senate. I'd say this is groundbreaking. You have a senator of the same party filibustering against his own leadership. And you go to nytimes.com, not a word about it. You go to washingtonpost.com, not a word about it. Go to cnn.com, not a word about it. Of course, he is saying, hey, these big corporations should not be allowed to break the law. And the big corporations controlling the corporate news in America really would rather not talk about that. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Roger in Hazel Park, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Roger, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, Tom, I am reading a book right now by Clyde Prestowitz, who is the counselor to the Secretary of Commerce under Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, and he's brilliant. Is the book you're reading One World Ready or Not?
No, it's 3 Billion New Capitalists.
Ah, yeah, okay.
It's a little old. But he points out in the book that, you know, these other countries that we are competing with, their governments are heavily investing in the production of goods. I mean, they are directly involved with, yep, you know, the government support plays a huge role. So not only, you know, are we competing against other countries that are providing free educations, but they also have the backing of their government in the production of their manufacturing.
Yeah, in Japan they have this thing called the Manufacturing and Industrial Trade Council, or something like that. It's MITI, is whatever the acronym is, MITI, and it actually aggressively supports research and development and supports promotion and trade of companies. In the United States, we have, and thank you, Roger, for pointing that out. In the United States, we have the Commerce Department, which is supposed to help American companies sell their products overseas and protect American economies, American companies. Instead, our Commerce Department is colluding with this government, with the tax laws that were passed between the Reagan, the Bush, the Clinton, and the Reagan and the Bush eras during this last 26 years. We now have tax laws on the books and policies that the Commerce Department is following that reward companies when they send jobs overseas. This is nuts. It's nuts. And you've got every single one of the Republican candidates going, I'm a free trader. I think this is wonderful. Yeah, let's send more jobs overseas. Time for that. Yep. John in Los Angeles. Hey, John, welcome to the show.
Hey, I just wanted to say that after hearing you talk about the that Tea Party thing, it sounded like all those buggy drivers back then knew more about what was going on than us Mercedes drivers know nowadays.
Well, they did. They had a free and independent press.
Free and independent. Did that mean it's non-commercial supported?
No, it was commercial supported. It was commercial supported, but every town, you know, over 5,000-10,000 people had two newspapers. I mean, it was, yeah. We actually subsidized newspapers in the beginning of this country. The newsprint was subsidized, the cost of newsprint was subsidized, and postage was subsidized. There's still a remnant of that. That's the fourth class rate. You can ship a newspaper for less than it actually costs to ship it. And that started during the revolutionary period or right after. And has been, you know, it's been around. We stopped subsidizing the print of newsprint as we led up to the Civil War, but that was the whole, and the only business, the only industry that is mentioned in the United States Constitution, and it's in the First Amendment to the Constitution, is the press. The press is the fourth branch of government for all practical purposes.
It sounds like further degrading of that idea is going on at the FCC as we speak.
Yes, Kevin Martin is feathering his own bed. He's getting ready for the time when he leaves the FCC, and he hopes that he'll have a multi-million-dollar-a-year job with one of the big radio, television, and newspaper combines, much like Colin Powell's son did when he left. So these guys are just, you know, just getting ready for their future. Carol in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Carol.
Good morning. On the Tea Party, couldn't we please throw George Bush in the ocean and tossing Cheney as a life preserver?
Yeah, we don't advocate violence or even just on
a couple
show,
of things.
So.
On the Gates H-1B visas,
yes,
I think there shouldn't be a single one of these visas issued until all of our graduates have good paying jobs and can pay off their student loans.
I agree. And just the idea of student loans is, in my mind, an obscenity, that somebody should have to borrow money to get an education. This is an investment in our future. And Japan gets it. You can get a PhD for free in Japan. Sweden gets it. You can get a PhD for free in Sweden. England gets it. You know, on a more limited basis, you can get a PhD for free in the United Kingdom. France certainly gets it. You can get a PhD for free there. Germany gets it. All over the world, there are countries with whom we are competing who get it. And they say to the best and brightest, and even sometimes the average, hey, if you want to get all the way to the top, will make it happen for you. But here in the United States, all they do is throw roadblocks in your way. It is nuts. Dan in Seattle. Hey, Dan. You're on the air, Dan. Dan? No Dan. Okay, Chuck in San Jose, California. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Hey, Tom?
Yeah, you're on the
air. Wow, all of a sudden you went real like and barely. There's a book by David Sirota, Hostile Takeover. Have you heard of it?
I have. In fact, I've read it. I think David Sirota is one of the most brilliant writers around.
Oh, yeah. Some of that information, you know, right in the beginning, it smacks dab what you're saying. Thomas Jefferson, 1816, said that any time we got this aristocracy.
Yes.
Right in the birth of this, what's going on today, it has to be crushed. And this is back in 1816, Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, he was talking actually about the first bank of the United States at that time.
Oh, okay.
But you know, again, he was talking about a corporation that ultimately would have enough power to control not only how business was done in the United States, but to be able to influence Congress. And he saw that as a terrible and dangerous thing. And he was right.
Have you ever had this David guy on your show?
Which David guy?
David Sirota.
Oh, David Sirota. Yeah, David Sirota's been on the program many, many times. He's a great guy. He just got a column, a syndicated column. He replaced Molly Ivins with, I think it's Creators Syndicate. And if David Sirota's column is not in your local newspaper, you need to call your local newspaper and say, David Sirota, the guy who replaced Molly Ivins, I want to read him, you know, once, twice, three times a week, however often he writes his columns, because he's absolutely brilliant. Stuart in Seattle. Hey, Stuart.
Yes, you finally got it when you said we shouldn't buy from China. You used to say we can't boycott or vote with our dollars because it puts the rich at an advantage. But you know that Henry Ford made his millions or hundreds of millions by all of the millions of people buying cars, not from the rich buying, not from thousands of rich buying hundreds of cars.
Yeah, I'm not saying that buying products from the U.S. is going to stop China from selling things to us. We need government policy for that. I don't disagree with boycotts. I think boycotts are noble efforts, and there have been some examples of boycotts that have worked. But I got an email the other day from a disabled person who said for the better part of 50 years, Americans with disabilities had been trying to boycott various institutions to get them to put ramps in and to make them wheelchair accessible. In 1 year, one piece of legislation, the Americans with Disabilities Act, changed all that.
We don't have control over legislation anymore. The rich people own the legislature.
Right, and that's why we need to be arguing very strongly for voter-owned elections. Those candidates who are willing to talk about election reform, we need to support them all we can. And it's another good reason why at the national level supporting the Democratic Party and at the local level supporting the Green Party is a good idea. Jim in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tom. On the Chris Dodd filibuster,
yeah.
76 voted to end the filibuster, 10 voted against terminating the filibuster.
So Chris Dodd got shut up and kicked off the floor.
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about it. Harry Reid clearly had a chance to bring up the Judiciary Committee bill instead of the Intelligence Committee bill and, you know, basically decided that in secret, which is where that intelligence bill was created, would rule the day, which is what Bush wants, and therefore the telecom immunity is going to go forward. Therefore, the lack of judicial oversight and much more restrictions on the domestic spying. I hate them calling it a domestic surveillance program. It's what they're doing is spying on us.
It's spying on you and me. It is the party in power being able to, or the party that controls the apparatus of it, being able to spy on the party that's not in power. I mean, this is absolutely Nixonian.
Sure.
Jim, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for the heads up on that. I appreciate that. The non sequitur, the cartoon today, this is so tragic, actually. And, you know, I like to read the comics in the morning. Here's, you know, this little girl, and she comes up the phone. Her dad's sitting next to the phone reading the paper, and she's da-da-da-da-da. And she picks up the phone and just says into it, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to whoever's listening, and then hangs up the phone. And he says, what are you doing, Kate? And she said, I'm sending my greetings to those nice government people who keep us safe by spying on us. And she walks off singing. And he sighs and he says, I miss the days when our imaginary friends were only imaginary. Yeah. 866-303-2270. The president of Quest apparently is out on bail. Brian in Boulder, Colorado, you wanted to set me straight on that?
Tom, your volume's pretty low. I can barely hear you.
Yeah, okay. We'll switch over to the other side of the board after this call. Thank you for the heads up on that, Brian.
What I wanted to say Well, first of all, I think you and your staff are a little bit disrespectful. Quest, first of all, used to be U.S. West, Phil Anschutz and Joe Nacho. Nacho's the guy who's out on appeal. And they ripped the company off and retirees and workers.
No, I'm not saying, I get that, Brian. I'm not, if I suggested he's in jail because he wouldn't testify, I was wrong. Thank you.
On the fifth day of Bushmas, my president gave to me a stop to the START treaty so we could be legal building Star Wars 2 to defend our lack of a democracy. On the sixth day of Bushmas, my president gave to me stock market tips to replace Social Security. On the seventh day of Bushmas, my president gave to me faith-based initiatives to replace Social Security.
Yes.
Bushmas,
all the days of Bushmas. And it goes on and on and on. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's hard to believe, Tom, that the president is winning on this FISA bill and the espionage powers, but it looks like he has somehow managed to do so.
So Chris Dodd is no longer speaking.
Well, definitely, and Senator Russ Feingold is definitely not speaking. There were essentially two versions of the bill. One was the Judiciary Committee version, and the one was the Intelligence Committee version. The Judiciary bill actually kicked it back to the courts and did not grant immunity, as I understand it, to the telecom company.
Right. This is Pat Leahy's bill.
Right. The Intelligence Committee does. They run with the Intelligence Committee bill. It's really quite astounding.
So where is Chris Dodd's? Now, we know that there was the 76-10 vote to limit debate on the wiretapping, but does that end the filibuster, or does that initiate the filibuster?
Well, as I understand it, and maneuvering is going on literally minute by minute right now on this, but as I understand it, that they have Harry Reid is kind of throwing Chris Dodd's objection down the hill and just going ahead with the bill.
With the bill that gives immunity to the telecom companies.
It gives immunity, that's right, and does not really have the court really pay much attention to it. And the bill that they're looking at, if anybody wants to look it up, is Senate 2248, and it's the Intelligence Committee bill.
Yeah.
How do we
replace Harry Reid as the leader of the Senate?
He's very popular, and in many respects, he's done a halfway decent job. The problem is that he's caving on this intelligence bill.
He's not just this intelligence bill. I mean, the Republicans have executed more filibusters in this legislative session than in any legislative session since the beginning of this country, and the average American doesn't even know that. And that's because the leadership of the Senate, A.K.A. Harry Reid. Has just rolled over. Every time the Republicans say, we're going to filibuster, he doesn't even know who's going to filibuster. He just believes that they have 40 votes and says, okay, we'll move on. We won't pass that piece of legislation. When the Democrats tried that on the Republicans, on Sam Alito, the Republicans said, we're going to pull a nuclear option. We're going to drop a bomb on your head.
The other problem is that their communications department doesn't, I mean, do you ever hear from the Republicans' communication department? I mean, from the Democrats' communication department on the Senate side? You never hear from them. So if they're not communicating with sort of like-minded hosts or media or people that may give them a fair chance, you don't even know where they're coming from. It's like you might as well be communicating with somebody in Afghanistan.
Yeah, no, I get regular emails from the Senate Democratic, the SDCC or whatever it is,
right.
You know, the campaign committee, and which seems to be more DLC than anything else. And of course,
don't hear
I get
what they're doing hour by hour or even day by day.
No, but I hear from the Republicans on a regular basis. I'll tell you
exactly
that.
Exactly my point.
And every talk show host in America does.
Exactly my point. Something else really interesting today. Never thought he'd have the guts, but as you know, Jane Harman and Pete Hoekstra are very involved in the whole issue of the tapes and the CIA tapes. here's a Pete Hoekstra, not exactly a Democrat, big Republican from Michigan, and he now has been told by the Justice Department, if they do their own investigation, that they are jeopardizing the investigation by the Justice Department. Nothing doing, he said. Basically, he said that they have no basis to do that and that they are going to go ahead with their own investigation into the destruction of the CIA tapes. Justice Department is not very happy about that. Mukasey is not very happy about that. But this is bipartisan. Very interesting.
Yeah, it's bipartisan with two people. What are the odds?
No, but they run the committee.
Yeah, but
they can run the hearings.
So just two people can make the committee do things? I thought they had to have a majority on the committee.
Two committee people can set the, if it's the ranking member and the member, in other words, Jane Harmon, who's the chairperson, and Hoekstra, who's the ranking person, if those two are together on it, hearings will happen.
Oh, really? I thought it took a majority. I didn't realize that. I learn something new every day.
Hearings as the chair people.
That's great. So when are the hearings going to begin?
Obviously not before Christmas, and I think their staffs are going to be working on it very much through the holidays.
Yeah. Is Harry Reid going to continue as he did over the Thanksgiving holiday? Is he going to keep the Senate in session through the Thanksgiving holiday so Bush cannot execute any more of these very toxic recess appointments?
I was up at the Senate Radio TV Gallery the other day, and that was the talk. We haven't heard an official announcement, but the talk is that they will keep a pro forma session going on in the Senate to prevent these appointments. And also, speaking of pro forma things, it looks like Mr. Rove is going to have his book proposal perhaps bid on this week, and we might know how much Rove is going to get for his memoirs.
Yeah, as if he's going to say anything that would land him in jail. He's going to be rewriting history as fast as he can. By the way, Sholene Espinosa was brilliant on 60 Minutes last night.
Well, thank you. We thought
brilliant.
So too.
She spoke in sound bites, and they were tight and pithy and right to the point. All about don't ask, don't tell, and the destruction that it does speak. And she had incredible credibility. I mean, they introduced her as a Air Force pilot and somebody who had the experience and now a commercial pilot. And she said, you know, you spent $2 million training me to be a pilot. You want to throw that away? I mean, it was brilliant. It was brilliant.
Well, thank you. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ellen. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. 57 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Stick around. We'll be right back. So what is our energy future? Seems like ultimately everything boils down to that when you turn on a light bulb, when you try and cook food, when you try to get from place to place. It all requires energy. We used to use energy literally from that day's sunlight. The horses would eat the grass that grew as a consequence of the sunlight, and we'd ride the horses or have them pull the plows. We'd use oil that we pressed from animals or got from whales and things, but now we're using ancient sunlight, sunlight that was put into the earth 300 to 400 million years ago in the form of oil, coal, natural gas, and ain't working so well. Congressman Jay Inslee is on the line with us. He has a new book out, along with Bracken Hendricks, forward by President Bill Clinton. It's titled Apollo's Fire, Igniting America's Clean Energy Economy. Congressman Inslee, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom.
Yeah, glad to have you with us. This book is tremendously optimistic. Why?
Well, because we've got some great science going on, and thank goodness we got geniuses in America, just like we had in the 1960s. And we believe, and the Apollo's Fire book basically tells the story of how we can do for energy what Kennedy did for space. And the reason Kennedy was successful in the space race is he had this inherent understanding of the innovative capability of the American people. We're the most creative, dynamic, technologically oriented society probably on Earth. And when you put us to work, we deliver. And that's going on all around the country. And I got to tell you, I was optimistic when I started writing Apollo's Fire, and I'm twice as optimistic now, because you really can't turn over a rock in this country without finding some inventor or some business person putting together a new plan for clean energy that will not be using up those eons of old sunlight like you described. We've got to start relying on new sunlight that we can get today, the wind that's driven by that sunlight, the biofuels energy that comes directly in that season from that sunlight, and perhaps some other really ancient forms of thermal energy below our feet and enhanced geothermal power. And we found that, you know, we believe that we can beat this monster of global warming if, and this is a big if people in Washington, D.C. will start adopting the policy of the American Eagle rather than the ostrich like we're seeing in the White House right now. And that's what we're working on this
week.
Yeah,
which brings me to the big problem. I mean, that's where we lost this week. I mean, we've got two major defeats. The first, the energy bill, where the Republicans succeeded in getting, and not just the Republicans, there are a few people on your end of the aisle as well. This happened in the Senate, not the House, I realize, and you're in the House of Representatives, but putting back in the, I think it's $13 billion in welfare for companies like ExxonMobil, the most profitable corporation in the history of the world since the Roman Empire, and stripping out the handing of that roughly equivalent amount of money over to industries and encouraging industries through things like tax breaks and tax incentives to develop the very kinds of energy that you're talking about in your bill. That's number one. And number two, in Bali, the president's representative there said, no, we're not going to play ball with you guys at all. He got booed down as a consequence of that. He said, okay, fine, we'll go along with something that says that in 2 years after George Bush is out of office, we'll have a meeting and we'll actually decide what to do. And between now and then, we're going to agree that we really should do something.
Well, if you want to know what it's like to talk to George Bush about global warming or energy, you can read this book, because I tell the stories of my efforts to drag him into this century, unsuccessfully to date. And this, as far as the energy bill this week, this is a perfect definition, whether you're an optimist or pessimist, because we made real tangible steps forward on three of the six things we have to do. We did make a success, and we broke the back of the opposition on CAFE standards, auto efficiency standards.
Yeah, but that took us to 35 miles a gallon.
Right, and I agree.
Right now, on average in Europe, it's 44 miles per gallon, and that's without legislation.
I'm driving a car that gets 45 miles a gallon today. But we did have good efficiency standards. We did have a good renewable fuel standard. What we lack, as you pointed out, in the next go-around with the next Congress and the next president, we are going to roll back those taxes for the oil and gas companies. Those are absurd, and we're going to take that money, we're going to put it in the innovative new economy that really Americans deserve. We're then, secondly, going to have a renewable electricity standard, which gives us 15% of our electricity from clean, renewable sources. These two things are going to become law, and they're going to become law at the latest by the fall of 2009. And then we're going to go on to the real great leap for mankind. Those are sort of five small steps for mankind, but the great leap forward is really the cap-and-trade system. And we are starting to turn our attention to that now, and that will become law, I believe, at the latest by the fall of 2009, when we pick up a few more votes in the Senate, people get Apollo's fire into their bones in this country, and we get a new president. And I just think history is on the march here, and the reason is because I can now go to my colleagues, as I did to my colleagues from Florida last week, and said, look, you guys didn't think you could do renewable energy. A company called Osra Solar Energy just signed a contract for 300 megawatts, enough for 250 to 300,000 homes down in Florida. They just signed a deal in Nevada to start their manufacturing base, and they just signed a deal for 177 megawatts in California.
Is this an American-owned company?
This is. It's an American-owned company. It's a leader of Vinod Khosla. The guy has invested in about two dozen clean energy companies.
That's great.
The Range Energy Biofuels Advanced Cellulosic Plant that just opened up to Oster, to a company called Altarock up in Seattle. Let me tell you what I found out when I wrote Apollo's Fire with Bracken Hendricks, my co-author. We found these companies were just sprouting like weeds after a rain. A company called Altarock up in Seattle is building a way to do enhanced geothermal, where you punch a hole down 3 kilometers, you pipe water down, you heat it up, comes back up at 300 degrees Fahrenheit, and boom, you heat that and you turn a steam turbine. There is enough energy literally to light the country up.
Yeah. They've been doing that in Iceland for 45 years.
Pardon?
They've been doing that in Iceland for 45 years.
Yeah, no, they're using hot water that just comes up naturally. What Altarock does is you actually fracture rock and you create a fracture zone, then you pump water down. So it is a new technology.
Uh-huh.
And what we're finding in Apollo's Fire is that those type of breakthroughs are coming out all across the country. And, you know, last week I was at the Anaheim Electric Car Convention, the 23rd Electric Car Convention. And as you pointed out, 35 miles a gallon is going to be nothing. We have plug-in electric cars that are ready to rock and roll in 5 years. They're on the streets already. I've driven them. These cars, you'll plug them in, you get 40 miles, zero CO2, zero gasoline, and you plug them in at night. And then you, after you drive 40 miles, you run it on a hybrid technology using gas or cellulosic advanced biofuels. You get somewhere between 100 and 500 miles a gallon. Now, that's a technology that's fitting for America's can-do spirit, and it's the kind of thing we can do if we'll adopt the policies that we advocate in Apollo's Fire. Yes. So we got some good news out there.
Well, let me share with you. Let's step into the Wayback Machine for a second, and I'd just like to get your thoughts on how we got from there to here, or how we didn't get from there to here. This was July 15th, 1979, the President of the United States.
The energy crisis is real. It is worldwide. It is a clear and present danger to our nation. These are facts, and we simply must face them. What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And then he continued to say,
moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Doesn't it make you want to cry?
It does. And I talked to Jimmy Carter when I was writing this book, and he pointed out that if we had simply continued the policies that he adopted in his presidency, which stopped when Ronald Reagan came into office,
right,
we would be free of Middle Eastern oil today. Now, if you can think of a more pathetic indictment a federal policy, I don't know what it would be.
Well, it's not just federal policy, it's a Republican policy. I mean, that's the bottom line here.
That has been the case when Reagan came into office. It certainly has been the case the last since Newt Gingrich came into Congress. Now, we're reversing that trend. We're turning this ship around. And I want you to leave this discussion with some little piece of optimism. Those three steps we took are a major, major break of the 30 years of studied indifference and resistance to change that the Republicans have put up. And we're starting to get some Republicans to join us. We've got Warner over in the Senate who is co-sponsoring a cap-and-trade bill. I've had Republicans who've read my book come over to me to the House, on the floor of the House, and say, look, we got to start working on this. So we are turning this ship around, and none too soon. We had a million square miles of the Arctic melt this summer. And time is not our friend here. We got to move.
Yeah, I agree. Congressman Jay Inslee, and hopefully you're having some conversations with a certain senator from Oklahoma. Congressman Jay Inslee, the book Apollo's Fire, Igniting America's Clean Energy Economy, a great book. Get out and pick up a copy of it. 16 minutes past the hour. Congressman Inslee, thanks so much for being with us. Good talking with you.
There's a certain comfort to know that the promises made will be kept by the government. You don't have to worry.
That's good, because I work three jobs and I feel like I contribute.
You work three jobs?
Three jobs, yes.
Uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic if you're doing that.
Thank you.
You get any sleep?
And Fortune magazine has the gall to run an op-ed titled Americans Are Lazy, or about how Americans are lazy because on the average worker at the average job is working fewer hours than they were 30 years ago. Well, that's because we're working three part-time jobs instead of one full-time job, because the full-time jobs have been offshored. Anyhow, Stuart Acuff is with us. He's the director of organizing for the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org, their website. Stuart, welcome to the program. Oh, Hang on just a second here, Stuart. Sorry, got to put you on the air.
Thanks. It's great to be with you again, Tom.
It's great to have you. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
There was a Congress here. This was last Tuesday, right?
Right, last Monday and Tuesday.
Okay, tell us about this.
Well, it was really a historic meeting. It was for the first time the global labor movement met here in Washington, D.C. at the George Meany Center to discuss the decline of union density and collective bargaining worldwide. We all know that the U.S. is leading that decline and that our density has dropped further faster in the last 30 years than anywhere else, but we're now exporting American-style union busting around the world, and multinational corporations headquartered here but headquartered all over the world are driving down workers' rights all over the world.
Yeah, Sarkozy is. I mean, this is the essence of what he's doing in France. He's the new Maggie Thatcher of France, isn't he?
That's exactly right. That's what he's doing. But there is good news. The Australians just voted out their conservative government and voted in a Labor government just 2 weeks ago. In Australia, they had given employers the right to terminate a union contract in the middle of the contract, unilaterally. So we see this rightward drift around the world, but we also see in lots of places workers fighting back, like here in the U.S., but other places as well.
Yeah. And this is, I mean, the reality here is that in 1935, with the Wagner Act and the creation of the National Labor Relations Board, we had the beginning of, I don't want to call it the legalization, but...
That's right. That's a good way to put
it. Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is that individuals are never going to have the power of a large corporation.
Right.
You know, aggregated capital is always going to outdo the power even of aggregated labor.
Right.
And without the force of we the people collectively, all of us as a society supporting labor, which
right.
means the government, we the people, supporting the right of labor. And the first assault on this came, you know, less than 16 months after the Republicans took the House and Senate in the election of 1946
right.
with the passage of the Taft-Hartley Act,
exactly.
which created these so-called right-to-work states and took a chunk out of the Wagner Act, and it's been
mm-hmm.
downhill ever since, although it really started going downhill fast when Ronald Reagan declared war on the middle class, working people, and the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, PATCO. Where... It seems to me that the, particularly given that the National Labor Relations Board members are appointed ultimately by the president, the tie-breaking
right.
vote anyway is appointed by the president, and so we've had, with the exception of a couple of years under Bill Clinton, we've basically had an NLRB that is hostile to the interests of working people, and then we had, you know, gutless Harry Reid. I'm getting over it with this guy. I don't understand why here he had an overwhelming support among the American people in the House and in the Senate for card check for the Employee Free Choice Act, and the Republicans said we're going to filibuster, and he didn't have the cojones to say, okay, fine, you want to filibuster, you're going to be up all night talking,
right, right.
and we're going to take names and we're going to kick butt,
right.
and he could have done it, and he should have done it, and he should do it again today, and I just don't get it.
Don't lose heart, Tom, because the Employee Free Choice Act is a long way from dead. We moved that legislation further, faster than anybody thought possible. We came out of the House with an overwhelming vote, and right, they stopped it with a filibuster in the Senate, but that legislation...
They didn't stop it with a filibuster. They stopped it with a threat of a filibuster.
Right. You're right. But that legislation is at the heart of the AFL-CIO's political program moving forward. And it will be a requirement of everybody who gets the endorsement running for federal office. It's all of the Democratic presidential candidates have endorsed it and signed their pledge to not only sign it, but to work for it. And that legislation, we're still fighting for it. We're going to fight it until we pass it. And, Tom, we intend to pass that legislation by the 4th of July, 2009, in the first 6 months of the next Congress and the next president. But that legislation is alive and well, and we're going to fight for it. Now, you know, with this meeting we had last week, people are all over the world are watching our fight here. We watched the fight in Australia. And all over the world, we're trying to figure out how better to work effectively, collectively, against this assault on multinational corporations and right-wing governments.
Well, Well, good on you, and God bless you. We so need this work, and people can participate, that can help out. There's even if you're not in a union, you can become a helper and a part of a branch of it over at AFLCIO.org.
Working America, Tom.
WorkingAmerica.org. That's right. Thank you. Thank you for the reminder, Stuart. Stuart Acuff, the Director of Organizing, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Not a moment too soon, without a minute to spare. You touched my heart when I didn't have a prayer. In my darkest hour, with my world filled with gloom, your sweet love saved me. Not a moment.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman program today brought to you by, in part, by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege.
That is just not right.
And what you are hearing in the background is Senator Kit Bond, the Republican from Missouri,
and I thought that
responding to... responding to this ongoing filibuster by Chris Dodd. Chris Dodd was speaking a few minutes ago, and then Kit Bond stood up and he said, hey, wait a minute, don't I have a chance to talk here too? And Jim Webb is chairing the Senate at the moment, and he said, okay, yeah, you can talk too.
This is what the Intelligence Committee said. We concluded that the providers had a good faith basis for responding to the request for assistance they received.
So, yeah, this is Kit Bond, and I'm They're, you know, we've got these two pieces of legislation, and it's kind of going back and forth, but it seems that this filibuster is still going on. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what's going on. The rules and the techniques and the strategies of the senator are just mind-bogglingly arcane, and the corporate media in America right now is not covering this thing at all, as far as we can tell. We are getting some information about it from Fire Dog Lake. The most recent the blog over there, FireDogLake.com, blogging quite well. Jane Hampshire, she said she contacted the Clinton Edwards and campaign and Obama campaigns last night. The only one who got back was Obama. He opposes giving retroactive communications to telecom companies. Both the Edwards and Clinton Edwards and Clinton campaigns said they are working on statements. So, you know, step by step, this stuff comes along. We'll keep you up to date. Tracy in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Tracy, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Enjoy your show. I have a sort of two-pronged question, and one is it's about Alan Greenspan, and he was being interviewed this weekend this week by George Stephanopoulos. And one thing I've noticed about him, and tell me if I'm just being a hostile witness, but it seems whenever Mr. Greenspan is interviewed, he deigns to answer questions. And when he does, he condescends and does it in kind of an arrogant, kind of convoluted fashion. That's kind of my minor point. I don't know if I'm, like I said, if I'm just being... if I just don't like him.
My impressions are similar to yours, that he's the royalty.
George Stephanopoulos said that Paul Krugman had made the assertion that historically home prices have been 30% higher than income and rents. And so he posed the question to Mr. Greenspan, and what frustrated me was Mr. Greenspan's answer. And what he basically asked him was, do you believe that Mr. Krugman's assertion, if it is correct, do we need prices to fall that far in order for the market to stabilize? And Mr. Greenspan basically said, prices will stabilize when the rate of liquidation of this very large overhang of newly built single-family homes is at a maximum. What the hell does he mean by that?
Yeah, what he means is by definition, I mean, it's almost like saying, you know, the bottom of a hole is the bottom of the hole. What he's saying is that when we hit bottom, we will have stabilized. There's no place farther to go. It's not an optimistic statement, frankly. You know, it's Greenspan speak. But that's all he was saying.
Well, does it mean that in order for the liquidation to happen, people have to buy it, and according to Paul Krugman,
not necessarily. They just have to put it on. Right. They don't necessarily have to buy them. They just have to be on the market. And as the price goes down and down and down, at some point people will begin buying again. And that's the point at which the price will stabilize. And the question is, you know, where's that going to be and how many more are coming? I'm telling you, there's more. This thing is going to play out for at least a couple more years. This is not something that is over. In fact, I think we're only about 30% of the way into it. And it's going to get worse, you know, particularly in those parts of the country that are particularly badly hit. You know, like I said, my weekend in Michigan was a real eye popper. So, Tracy, if you want to learn more about Alan Greenspan, go read Ravi Batra's book, Greenspan's Fraud. It's an absolutely brilliant piece of economic literature. It's very, very readable, very accessible. Yeah. And
thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Jim in Van Nuys, California. Hey, Jim.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on what that one lady said a couple hours ago regarding Bush and Cheney, and believe me, nobody hates them more than I do. But let's not be too hasty about it. Let's let the international community take care of them the way that the international community took care of, who am I thinking of, 1961.
Yeah, Goebbels and Goering. And 1961. Oh, yeah, yeah. Eichmann.
Eichmann. That's who. Because in the eyes of the American conservative, these guys are princes, and they're already building the largest
presidential library
in Baghdad. Yeah. Let's not make it any worse by. You know.
Here's the problem, Jim. The old cliche, history is written by the victors. The victors actually get to make an awful lot of the choices. And we were the victors in World War II, and so we were able to push the process with the International Court in The Hague and say, you know, we're going to hold responsible the Nazis for the Nazi war crimes. Frankly, I don't think that there is a major country in the world right now that is willing to take us on. So I hold
Nader and the third party movement responsible for this.
Nader did not lose the election for Bush. I mean, he made it arguably in Florida. He made it tight enough that it could be stolen. But even he did not do that really. It was really election theft. It was election. I mean, they in Florida, they were sending out flyers to people in African American communities saying you're supposed to vote on Wednesdays instead of Tuesdays. They sent out to tens of thousands of African Americans in Florida things saying turnout is going to be so heavy that instead of voting at the school down the street, you're supposed to vote at the school 20 blocks away. They get to that school 20 blocks away, they stand in line for 9 hours, and then they get up to the front of the line and they're told, oops, you're in the wrong school, you got to go back to the other one, and there's a 9-hour line there. You had tens of thousands of people, maybe as many as 80 or 90,000 people illegally thrown off the voting rolls because somebody in Texas had committed a felony and had a similar name, not even an identical name. This was a stolen election in 2000. And not only was it stolen in Florida, but they never even counted all the votes. You know, the Supreme Court stepped in. This was a coup. This was a coup. And I don't think that we can blame Ralph Nader for a coup. I'm sorry. As much as I was upset with him, and told him so, and I did not vote for him or advocate his presidency in 2004, although I confess I did vote for him in 2000. But I lived in Vermont. It was a safe state, and I wanted the Green Party to get those federal matching funds. But it's not that simple. What we are dealing with here is a criminal enterprise. The Republican Party, they even flipped the stars upside down on the elephant. Have you noticed that? That from the traditional stars of America, where you've got the five-pointed star with the point on top, you know, and the two arms out on the side and the feet down at the bottom, they flipped it upside down. So now you've got a single star down on the bottom, like the goat's chin, the goat's whiskers, and the two stars up at the top, like the goat's horns, and the two stars out on the side, like the goat's ears. This is the traditional, positioning of stars by Satan worshippers. I mean, it's Google, you know, upside down star and Republican Party. It's so bizarre. When Bush took over, they flipped the stars upside down. It's totally, totally bizarre. Toby in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Toby.
Hey, Tom, I am an activist and get out and do things for the Democratic Party, but I can't stand them today. And I tried calling Harry Reid's office in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to go to his comment line, it's full. And if you try to go and talk to someone, you get a busy signal. So I called one of the Nevada offices and gave them a piece of my mind. And I hope others will do the same if they're running into that problem.
Yeah,
because he's got to know how wrong he is.
Yeah, I agree. And those numbers are all over at his website at Harry Reid's, and you can Google that very quickly. Toby, thank you very much for your activism, and good on you for that. John Cornyn now is speaking.
As many as two-thirds of the communications of one foreign terrorist to another foreign terrorist.
Yes, this is the Republican from Texas. How about the communications between Ted Kennedy and Pat Leahy that you've been listening in on? We know you hacked into their computers. There's never been an investigation of that, but there was an admission of guilt. Amazing. Frank in Los Angeles. Got about a minute before a break here, Frank. What's on your mind?
You know, what I can't get over is the fact that they're trying to resurrect Ronald Reagan as the world's greatest president.
Oh, they want to put him on Mount Rushmore and on the dime.
Exactly. I mean, how obscene is that? You know, why are they getting away with it? It's just that the media, the Republicans control the media, and they have been since Ronald Reagan, because they never said anything bad about Ronald Reagan. In fact, all the mistakes that he made were retracted like a week later, so nobody mentioned.
No, you ask why, and the why is very simple. Ronald Reagan turned control, and it had been a slow process that had been happening ever since 1886, but Ronald Reagan turned control of America over to multi and transnational corporations. Corporations who have no allegiance to America in many cases. Many of them aren't even headquartered in America anymore. You've got Halliburton moving over to Dubai. He turned it over to these corporations, and these are the same corporations who own the corporate-owned media and whose, you know, paid apologists are on TV all the time. So, of course, they're going to lionize him. I mean, he's their guy. 45 minutes past the hour.
Pilgrims in the parking lot, arteries clogged with blood clots, pushing through the aisles of department stores. Neon crosses and Christmas lights, credit card debts and brand new bikes. The holidays are here and we're still at war. The rabbi reads from the testament, the banker gazes at the year's investment, salvation Santa solicits for the poor. Deception of democracy, the philanderings of faux foreign policy, the holidays are here and we're still at war.
9.5 minutes past the hour, the debate is going on in the Senate about the FISA laws. These two different, these competing pieces of legislation. Now the Republican John Cornyn is speaking.
Required, and the Protect America Act made that temporary fix. We need to make that permanent.
He's speaking in favor of the Intelligence Committee's bill, the one that would give immunity to the telco companies.
Would hamper our intelligence capabilities, requiring procedures never before in place. Intelligence community resources, both funding and expertise, are scarce.
Yeah, right. Okay. Thanks a lot, John. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Robert in Torrance, California. Hey, Robert. Robert?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Oh, yeah, okay, I'm sorry. Let me put you over on the other side of the board. Maybe you can hear me a little better. Hey, what's up?
Yeah, I was just going to quote Thomas Jefferson about the banking institutions and homelessness.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Are you going to do it? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, go for it. You're on the air.
Oh, I thought you were, okay, the other side of the board. Okay, well, how you doing?
Good.
I believe Jefferson said this. I forget where I wrote this down a few years ago, but in 1809, Jefferson wrote, "Banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies.
Yep.
If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that grow up around these banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent of their fathers." Yeah. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs.
Yeah, this was one of the absolute, thank you, Robert, this is one of the absolute biggest battles that happened during the Washington, the Adams, and the Jefferson presidency was whether or not there should be a U.S. bank, a federal bank. Alexander Hamilton was the biggest advocate for it. He got his way, and then that bank went bankrupt. It got shut down, and then the second American bank came along, and as I recall, that was it Zachary Taylor? It was one of those, whoever there was the president in the 1830s, finally shut that one down. And then in 1913, we got the Fed. I think Jefferson was prescient. Derry in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Derry.
Hi. Listen, real quick. Greenspan. Greenspan speaks because he's Greenspan. When he says things, the market instantaneously responds. So he cannot speak necessarily with absolute. Secondly, the bottom, the reason why he talks so fuzzy about the liquidity and the bottom, we got to be able to bring that back in layman's term. What he's saying is the bottom is when the speculators have bought up all the property, or at least the majority of the property is such that the prices are turning back. This gets the load off of the banks. That's what he's talking about. This is about money. This is about following that.
And he's the one who brought it all about by giving us net negative interest rates. He dropped interest rates to the point where they were below the level of inflation, in my opinion, in order to help George Bush get elected. And that's what fed this housing bubble. I mean, it was just absolutely predictable.
Let's not forget, though, this is where the rich really get rich. This is the payoff. This is where
they can buy up, you know, as much as a third of America at fire sale prices now.
Pennies on the dollar.
Yep.
This is the payoff. This is a cycle. We just gotta be aware of it and realize it's happening. In fact, I hate to say it, but when in Rome, you do what? You do as the Romans do. We might have to join them, Tom.
Yeah, the next couple of years might be a very good time to be buying land. You're absolutely right, Derry. Yep. Thank you very much, Jonathan, in Jersey City, New Jersey. If you have the cash, I mean, that's the problem. It's going to be a very, very small percentage of us who have the cash to do it. Jonathan, what's on your mind today?
Tom, in lieu of your comments on Friday's show where you stated your belief that progressives would be better served calling and writing Democratic members of Congress to tell them we'll support them and be behind them if they start voting as actual Democrats, rather than calling them and telling them we'll work for their ouster if they continue operating as Republicans light in view of...
And then today I asked, how do we get Harry Reid out of the leadership? I know I'm schizophrenic here.
Well, I mean, as a lifelong Democrat and activist, it's insane. These people know why and what they were elected to do. The fact that so many of them do the things they do, like Harry Reid being the latest example, tells me one of three things. Either these so-called Democrats are either complete and utter cowards, they've been bought and paid for, or they're being blackmailed.
I think it's all three.
Okay.
I absolutely think that it's all three, and I think that they are scared to death. Jonathan, thanks for making the point, and you made it very well. Judy in Mahwah, New Jersey. Hey, Judy, got a little less than a minute here left.
Okay, quick procedural suggestions. If the comment lines are busy, which they often are, send a fax. If you have all, it has the impact of a letter without having to go through anthrax screening, and then you can send the same fax to a lot of members. And today I just did get through to Harry Reid and said he had to resign. This last betrayal is too much. But I fax them all quite regularly, and it has more impact, I think, than just the spoken comment.
You got through to his office.
The fax line's pretty easy. And I did on a fluke get through the comment line today, but I fax them all the time. My representatives and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, begging them to please lead and please represent the Democrats who are losing all respect for them.
Yeah. Thank you, Judy. Good on you. We do need, you know, okay, am I being schizophrenic here? No, ultimately, I don't think so. We do need to say, hey, we don't like this, and we're with you if you'll do this. I mean, any good motivation strategy has two pieces to it. We have to hold the ideal for the future of America. Coming up Tuesday on the Tom Hartman Program, Larry Pratt from GunOwners.org and I are going to debate whether school principals and teachers should be armed to stop school massacres. Larry Mitchell's here on the speculation economy, how finance triumphed over industry. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.